It's going?
Good evening. The Legislative Commission on Pensions and Retirement will come to order. Members, we have a quorum. That's super. I would like to have a motion on the approval of the minutes.
Madam Chair, so moved. So moved.
Senator Jasinski moves the April 18th minutes. Representative Murphy.
I have a correction.
Thank you. Representative Murphy.
I have a correction. Under Rick Heller, unofficial representing twice exceptional and print disability, testified regarding accessibility of legislative documents and timely posting. And the clerk has that in writing.
Any questions? Thoughts on the change of the amendment to the motion? Okay. All those in favor of that oral amendment, say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, nay. Motion prevails. And Senator Jasinski renews his question on the motion of the approval of the minutes. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, say nay. Motion prevails. Thank you. And members, we have three more items to go through tonight. One non-action item is the MSRS unclassified change in factors for converting an account to annuity. Ms. Lencheski.
Thank you, Senator Rosen. The issue that we are just providing information on relates to the unclassified plan. Last summer, members of the unclassified plan received notice from MSRS that as of the coming July 1, 2017, so this coming summer, a change in the factors used to calculate annuities will take effect, and the result will be that if a member retires and elects to have his or her account be distributed in the form of an annuity, the monthly amount will be less on July 1 than it would have been on June 30th. There were a number of contacts made to our office as well as to some of the legislators over in the state office building and probably others in the Senate office building relating to this change in the factors. There is concern because certain staff people and others may be looking at retirement earlier than they would have had the factors not changed. So we were asked to look into this and gather some information. After reviewing some samples of the notice and the change in the annuity amounts, we were able to determine that the reduction to annuities will be approximately 7%. So people will be getting about 7% less as a monthly amount on July 1 than they would have on June 30th due to this change in the factors. Just to be clear, though, this relates only to the unclassified plan. The unclassified plan is a defined contribution plan, so a small subset of state employees and legislators are in this plan. In your package of materials, there's a memo that I drafted that lays out some data just to indicate how I guess small in the scheme of things this plan is. There are $312 million in assets under investment. And there are about 1,380 active members, total members about 3,226 as of June 30th of 2016. So this only deals with the unclassified plan. The unclassified plan is connected to the MSRS general plan, which is a pension plan, in two important ways. One is that within certain time frames, members can elect to transfer their account over to the general plan and receive a pension from the general plan. Another connection that is different than what I just discussed or just mentioned is that a member, when they're ready to retire, can elect to have their account balance converted to an annuity and distributed. That is what we're talking about, the second feature, where someone takes their account and elects to receive it not in a lump sum, but in the form of a stream of payments for life. When MSRS does that, it applies factors. So this conversion is based on factors that are based on the assumptions, the actuarial assumptions that have been approved by the commission. The statute, as we talked actually last meeting, the statutes require that when the assumptions change, and those changes are approved by the Pension Commission, when that occurs, the factors need to be updated to reflect the new assumptions. MSRS went ahead and did that. There is a statute also that we kind of uncovered late in the process that requires MSRS to notify the Pension Commission when that happens and provide an implementation schedule. That was not done in this case, so this did come as a bit of a surprise to members of the Pension Commission when they found out several months later that their approval of the assumptions meant that the factors under the unclassified plan would be updated or changed. So in digging into this a little bit deeper, the question that we were wanting to look at was whether there still is a better benefit under the unclassified plan than there would be if you took your lump sum and went to an insurance company and bought an annuity. So working with the executive director of MSRS, we were able to get some quotes from an insurance company. Using the same lump sum amount, what would that be from the insurance company? And then we compared that to what the annuity is from the unclassified plan. The data is in the memo, but the kind of the upshot of all that is that we didn't see that there was a lot of difference. So the annuity is fairly similar under the unclassified plan with the taking into account the new factors as it would be from an insurance company. There are a couple of benefits, though, that you will have if you elect an annuity from MSRS General rather than go to an insurance company. The one is that this gets a little complicated and is also discussed on page 5 of my memo, but if a member goes ahead and takes their account, elects an annuity, and begins to receive that annuity and dies before they receive the entire value of the account, MSRS will pay you the difference between the annuity payments that have been paid out and the amount of your account that have been transferred over. That is actually not in the statutes, but MSRS pays that benefit. That is not something you'd find in an insurance company. The second benefit is a bounce-back feature, which is if you can elect several forms of annuity. If you elect, instead of a single life, you elect a joint and survivor annuity, and your survivor dies before the member does, that joint and survivor will bounce back or become a single life annuity, which is a larger benefit than the joint and survivor. That, too, is not something that you would get from an insurance company unless you paid for it. So those two benefits, while they are not in the statute, are being paid by MSRS and does make the annuity a better deal, I guess, than you would get if you took your lump sum and went out to an annuity company or an insurance company. So that is kind of what we uncovered. It does lead to some questions, such as why didn't we get notice? And that is something I think that will be corrected going down the road. And then secondly, we may want to look the commission may want to look at some of these benefits that are being provided that are not now covered by the statute. Either we do them in the future or we amend the statute. If we want to do them, we amend the statute. If not, then we don't pay these out. With regard to this change in the factors that will occur on July 1, I laid out some alternatives for consideration if the commission would like to do that. One is to phase in the reduction. Another would be to delay the effective date a year or two. And then the third would just simply to say, don't use the new factors. Stick with the old factors and the benefit that people would be expecting on June 30th.
Okay. Thank you. Any thoughts, questions, members? Representative Murphy?
Madam Chair, members of the Commission, I asked Ms. Lincheski to draw this memo up, and we've had several conversations about it and about the situation. I appreciate that Ms. Leonard from MSRS came before us last week and talked about the factor changes and that they had complied with the law. I expect in the future as a result of this experience that when factors change and plans send out letters because of factors changing, that the commission will be notified. And that when there's major letters sent out about plan changes, that we know about it at the same time that our constituents or the former employees would be receiving the letters. I have looked at the options and the next steps, and I think we should consider them at a later time. I think that people are ready, and we're just going into the 60-day time period that they have before July 1st to make the decision. I know that people have asked, because of hearsay, why is so-and-so retiring, and why did the Pension Commission make that change? Well, the Pension Commission didn't make the change. The Pension Commission didn't know, and I didn't have an answer. And I don't want that to happen again in the future. And I think the memo explains it. The people have made they've had the letter for a year. They've made their decisions, or they are making them, or will make them in the next 60 days. And we will talk about the options for another circumstance. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Representative Murphy. This, of course, will require some legislation. Is that being drawn up, may I ask? Maybe I should ask.
I have received what I have asked for.
Okay, thank you. Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just wondering, given that we are reportedly have a workforce shortage in Minnesota, what kind of impact this might have on state government and how many people are going to be retiring early. And, you know, I wonder if we could get that. I don't know who would provide us with that information, maybe MSRS or MMB. But I think it'd be very useful to know that we might have to do some really aggressive hiring strategies to make up for all the lost talent we could be losing with us. And it would have been good to know ahead of time, I agree, with Representative Murphy, so that more planning could have gone into this by the different state agencies.
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly something that we can look at over the interim to address it next year. Representative Albright.
Madam Chair, and this question may be directed at Ms. Lincheski, but I'm wondering in the context of the provisions as they seek to be amended, if there was any consideration of grandfathering the old language with current participants as of a date specific, and then moving forward with the new provisions, say after those employed after a certain date, as compared with just making them effective for everyone, in terms of you might have some folks in here 20, 30 years who now are faced with the proposition of retiring before they want to just for the sake of a reduction in their annuity, as opposed to someone who has been here 2 or 3 years and afforded the same luxury. And I'm just wondering if that's another way to maybe address what Senator Pappas is driving at in terms of retention of very valued people and not forcing their hand for retirement, but in a kind of an alternate way, recognizing that that talent is revered and should be rewarded in some fashion.
Ms. Lincheski.
Yes, Senator Albright and Senator Rosen, that certainly would be a way to deal with this. You could grandfather the current employees. You could carve out the group that will be affected by you could go with sort of the younger crowd, I suppose, the ones who will have plenty of time to plan around this change, and then grandfather in everybody who's within 5-10 years of retirement. that is certainly something that we could do by way of, legislative change.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Ms. Lencheski. I'm just wondering if there's counsel that we might engage just to consider that as an opposition, an opportunity. I do think that that's that would be a meaningful opportunity, I think, for people to not have to be forced into a decision that may be premature and allow them some opportunity to prepare in a timely fashion as opposed to rush to a decision that is not of their own doing mm-hmm. before their time. Mm-hmm. So thank you.
Ms. Lencheski.
I guess I'll just ask Senator Rosen. Senator Albright, are you suggesting that we should prepare some legislation, do you think, then, that would have a grandfather provision in it? Is that
Representative
like
Albright?
To have a spring forward?
Madam Chair and Ms. Lencheski, yes. I would propose that just to, I think, further refine those that maybe, again, are looking at this with some amount of trepidation over the loss of income that was planned, but now because of the change is a loss, there's an inherent commitment that we've made to these people based upon provisions, longstanding. And so even though we have attempted to make communication of the change in benefits, I do think that there needs to be a window of opportunity that may be afforded to these people that right now seems a bit short and abrupt. So if, Madam Chair, you would indulge that, I would certainly seek that for the consideration of the commission.
Thank you, Representative Albright. I believe that is a good recommendation to have commission staff to work on that. Appreciate that, Ms. Lencheski, and your work on this, too. We are planning on voting the omnibus pension bill out next week. So I think this is something too what we will be working over in the interim and be prepared to vote on it next year. Yep. Okay. Super. Thank you very much, Ms. Lencheski, for your work on this, and Representative Murphy for bringing that to our cause. Senator Senjum.
Madam Chair, just a question. Someone who would cash out on a lump sum would not lose, if you will, that 7%. Is that correct?
Ms. Lencheski.
If they leave and take their benefit in an annuity prior to the end of June or as of June 30th, they would not lose the 7%. So this only comes up if they take their lump sum and elect an annuity. Anybody can take their lump sum at any time, and this particular change doesn't have any impact on that lump sum.
Senator Dames.
Thank you, Chair Rosen and Ms. Lencheski. A couple of questions. So if somebody on July 1st applies for an annuity, they'll have the lower percentage, correct? So if we build it in that people up to a certain length of employment or a certain employment date still qualify for the old numbers, which would be higher, 7% higher, where's that 7% going to come from? Because we're basing the new numbers on actuality. So where is what pot's the 7% going to come out of to do that? Somebody's going to come up shortchanged some point along the line. Where is that going to come from?
Ms. Lencheski.
Senator Dames and Senator Rosen, yes, that is the issue. The 7% will come out of MSRS General. So it will come out of the pension plan. So they'll transfer their account over. And if we use old factors that don't reflect new assumptions, there will be a shortfall in the account that goes over, and it will have to come out of something, and it will come out of that pool of assets.
Senator Dames.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So what we're doing is we're setting ourselves up for an issue then that we're having in some of the other funds. We're setting ourselves up for that issue then down the road if we do this. Is that correct?
Ms. Lencheski.
Madam Chair, Senator Dames, that is true, although a pension plan is just a giant pool of assets,
correct.
So it just means that it will be even more underfunded than it currently is. That's correct.
Right. Thank you.
Okay. Further questions? Representative Murphy.
Madam Chair, on that point that was just made, Ms. Lincheski, in your opening remarks, though, you said that this is only with the unclassified plan, and MSRS is the only fund that has an unclassified plan at this time.
Ms. Lincheski.
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Murphy, that is true. So this is going. This hit that we're talking about here to the general plan will be minuscule in comparison to the rest of the assets because it is only with respect to the unclassified plan and these, you know, handful of people that are in that plan.
Okay. Okay. Super. Further questions? Again, thank you very much, Ms. Lincheski, for your work on this. Representative Murphy, we are going to lay this over and continue to work on it. So we have action item number 3 in front of us, Senate File 1384 and House File 1672. It's the implementing the recommendations of the Volunteer Fire Relief Association Working Group. And Ms. Barth, if you would like to go through that bill, please.
Madam Chair, would you like the testifiers to go through the bill or me?
Oh, maybe the testifiers would be great. Thank you. Welcome.
Welcome, Madam Chair.
Please state your name for the record.
Members of the committee. My name is Ron Johnson, and I'm a member of the State Auditors, the State Auditors Volunteer Working Relief Association Working Group. And I'm here representing Minnesota State Fire Department Association. I've also had the honor of serving as a firefighter in Maple Grove for the past 21 years, and 20 of those years as treasurer of the Relief Association. So while I certainly don't have all the answers, I certainly am fighting for our 19,000 firefighters in the state of Minnesota. As you may know, there's about 631 fire relief associations in the state, and there's a defined benefit, defined contribution plans, and the working group works very hard throughout the year to take a look at the issues that the firefighters across the state, both metro as well as outstate, have before them. It's about 546 of those plans are defined benefit, and at about 85 are defined contribution. So there's a lot of diversity amongst different plans as well as the firefighters of the state. The working group was created in 2004 to bring together the various relief association stakeholders groups. The primary objective or the ultimate goal actually is to help Volunteer Fire Relief Association pension plan trustees manage and oversee the plans. As you know, there's 9 members on each relief association board. 6 of those are voted in by the members, firefighter members, and another 3 are appointed by the local municipality. On the working group, we have both metro and state, outstate area representatives. In fact, Niall, my counterpart here, has served many, many, many years, and I'm sure you probably know Niall from all the history that he was one of the founding members back in 2004. The state auditor is the one who coordinates and directs our meetings, and we meet prior to legislative sessions, obviously, so predominantly in the fall, early January. So the bill before you is the annual Volunteer Fire Relief Association Working Group Bill. And as in the past, all legislative proposals included in the working group bills have received unanimous consent from the working group members. So we're here tonight to basically give you a quick summary of the section of the bill, or by section. Section 1 simply clarifies that the Relief Association audits must include a legal compliance audit. This change is in keeping with the practice that auditors should already be following and is consistent with the requirements of all other local units of government. Section 2 clarifies the Corporate Stock Investment Authority so that compliance with the statutory investment restrictions is measured based on the underlying securities owned by the pension plan and not by how the securities were purchased. This change helps close a loophole that currently allows REIT associations to invest in any mutual fund or exchange-traded funds without limitation, even those that hold commodities, futures, and other speculative securities. Sections 3 through 9 and 11 through 19 make technical corrections to update the definitions of fire department and municipality in the relief association statutes to accommodate the joint powers of fire departments across the state. The Office of the State Auditor worked with staff from the Revisor's Office the past year to make these updates. The terms are used numerous times throughout the Relief Association statutes, and each reference was reviewed and updated as appropriate. Section 10 clarifies that the return to service provision in a statute applies only to firefighters who return to active service after a break in their service or a leave of absence. And this change corrects a drafting mistake and is purely a technical correction. And the last section, Section 20, clarifies that a volunteer firefighter for purposes of eligibility for supplemental benefits includes individuals who perform or supervise the prevention duties or emergency response duties if the local fire relief association and municipality have approved these positions as eligible for relief association membership. In other words, it's part of their bylaws. That's what we've got this year in terms of the bill. That's a quick summary.
And Madam Chair, members, Niall Zickman representing the Minnesota Fire Chiefs, and a little historical perspective. Back in the Dutcher auditor era, I had advocated for the office to take on the role of convening a work group as we came down here year after year on our own. Wasn't successful, but with Auditor Anderson coming to office, she's seen the wisdom of that, and Auditor Otto has continued the wisdom of that. I just want to highlight three of the sections. Section 1 on the audit, that's become one of the most expensive part of Relief Association operation, and as you know, the auditor does the oversight, so you get the audit done by the CPA, and then it goes off to the oversight, which is more of a legal compliance, and we end up revisiting the issue and incurring additional costs. So we had advocated, you know, to get that clarified. That really is a legal complianceer. $10,000-$12,000 is not unusual, typical on a larger plan for those audits. The Section 10, that return to service, has been a huge issue. I'm just listening to the workforce issues and allowing people to come back. That was a change we made 4 or 5 years ago to allow people, you know, to come back. And so that just continues the efforts to help us get the volunteers. And the last one was a 3-year in the making process, and it's similar to the prevention provision that was added almost 20 years ago, where fire departments need a variety of different people to fill a variety of different roles, and the pension is a powerful recruitment but even more powerful retention tool. And as about 80% of all fire calls now are EMS, to hire EMS only is helping those local communities. So this will again address the continuing crisis of the shortage of volunteer firefighters.
Mr. Zickler, what section is that?
So that's Section 20 that now allows. I'll highlight Isanti, Minnesota, as one that was advocating, as 80% of their calls are EMS, and their previous recruits were like me. They didn't want, we call it the blood and guts, if I can be coarse. We wanted to fight fire, mm-hmm. and I didn't care for the crash rescue. But there are people who do, and so they can recruit EMS only and use the pension to recruit them and then retain them and relieve the burden from the suppression only. So it's a pretty major provision. And we had it in last year's bill, which everybody knows what happened to that. So it's back again with clarification. So I just wanted to point out some additional points on those three in particular because they're pretty important.
Great.
Thank you, members.
Members, questions for Mr. Zickman or Mr. Johnson? Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to the testifiers, I'm looking on page 2 of the bill. And I have questions under Section B of Section 2 with regard to the expanded list of authorized investments. And I'm not sure to whom this should be addressed, but in my background, I'm fairly familiar with what you're describing on line 2.28. And I will tell you from a fiduciary's perspective, unless that is clarified to the satisfaction of a trustee, you're going to send someone to an early grave.
Mr. Zickman.
Madam Chair, members, the copy I have doesn't show any underline on 2.28.
No,
Representative Albright.
It does not, but in your conversation on your summary, in discussions with Representative O'Driscoll, we also share the concern that it doesn't prohibit a trust or an organization from investing in what we would consider naked puts or naked calls, or if they are leveraged or non-leveraged. And so just for satisfaction, what are you describing or not prohibiting in that section or in your summation?
Mr. Zickman.
So, Mr. Chair, or Madam Chair, members, I'm still at a loss. So you're talking the summaries on the Corporate Stock Investments Authority? So I am not an expert in that area, and I believe the auditor's office has a staff person here that can talk to that provision. They'd be better qualified to answer than me or Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Johnson. Yeah. We could bring up Mr. Kerr from the auditors. Okay.
Yeah,
Mr. Kerr.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, I'm Mark Kerr. I'm an attorney at the Office of the State Auditor. And I think, I may have to go back and talk to people at my office about this exact issue. I think the intent of this section was to make sure under G on page 5 that when you look at the investments that a trust is in, you look through the form of it being shares in a mutual fund to what's actually in the fund, so that all the contents of that mutual fund investment are subject to all the limitations of the rest of the subdivision. But I can certainly take a specific question back to the office and get an answer for you.
Representative Albright.
Madam Chair, thank you. Mr. Kerr, so just so I reiterate what I hope that I just heard from you, that given that you are availing see-through investment vehicles to these organizations, it's not that they are investing in puts or call options individually, but you are authorizing and understanding that through those mutual funds or indexes that they themselves would be authorized to invest in puts and calls.
They would be authorized to invest in whatever is allowed by this subdivision, subject also to the limitations of the subdivision. That's my understanding.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Kerr, would it not be advisable then to also include an understanding that the prospectus of that mutual fund or that index would incorporate everything that you're trying to subdivide here, and it would be more all-inclusive if you wrapped your arms around it in that way?
Mr. Kerr.
Madam Chair and Representative, I don't have an opinion on that, but I could certainly talk to people at my office and we could maybe come up with some language.
Representative Albright.
Madam Chair, and thank you. Mr. Kerr, I think that just keeps us out of some snares that wouldn't necessarily be of our own doing, but the understanding is clearly, you know, advisable, but I think the way that we're going around it from my experience is one that we could certainly step into something that would be not well advised.
Thank you.
Representative Albright, are you concerned? Is this something that you would like to delay the vote on tonight because of this section?
I think it's something that we can address in the interim, but I think it's just something that we should be putting on our radar screen to make sure that we're streamlining the process without making it overcomplicated, just for the sake of trying to, in a sense, preempt or to be proactive, but maybe we're just wrapping ourselves around the axle a little bit too tightly on that, and we can do it more simply. if we just take a look at it in the interim.
Well, I think you brought up an issue that has other concern for other people, too. Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just will ping off a little bit of what Representative Albright shared. In statute, we direct the State Board of Investment with a list of investments that they can, as professional advisors and a professionally qualified staff that does this on a full-time basis on behalf of the plans, with a directive of what they can and cannot invest in. And Senator Pappas and Representative Murphy will both recall back in 2013, 2014, there was some discussion about allowing for some derivatives to be introduced to that list, and the two people, the person to my right and myself, got on top of that as concerns about what did that mean for derivatives, because that's, again, depending upon who you talk to, one of the things that caused the 2008 market crisis and financial crisis that resulted from that. My assumption is that each of these trusts and plans would also have an investment statement, and there'd be an investment advisor that you'd have to look at, and certainly needing something codified in statute to direct what is and what isn't permissible. But I share wholeheartedly Representative Albright's concern about naked calls and naked puts, and just for a quick definition, it means there's no underlying security you're buying in the marketplace, hoping that on the roll of the dice that what you hoped to buy for that investment happens. You don't own the equity, you don't own the position, you just hope it moves one way or the other so you can make some money on it without actually owning an underlying security, and that can be extremely, extremely risk laden.
Thank you, Representative O'Driscoll. Further questions on that one? Okay. Yes, Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So when did we pass subdivision B? Or
I'm sorry, what's that?
When did we pass subdivision 2B?
We have the whole bill in front of us, Representative Thiessen.
Well, that's current law.
Right.
So I'm asking when we I'm wondering if anybody has died, no. I guess, since we passed that bill.
Do you remember, Mr. Johnson? We can find that, but it's probably been a couple of years.
Right, and so we haven't had any problems. This is the point I'm trying to make.
I see. No. Representative O'Driscoll.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. To Representative Thiessen's point, you don't know you have a problem until you have a market condition and you get litigation against you on something on this. We're just trying to be a little proactive as all.
Okay. Good. Okay. Mr. Kurt, do you have any comments on the bill?
No, not unless there are questions.
Okay. Okay, super. Thank you. Do have a technical amendment in front of us. Members, it's the A17-0222. I think it's somewhat explanatory. Do you all? Yeah, Ms. Barth.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So this just goes to the one of the definitions that the reviser worked closely with the working group on related to adding joint powers into the definition. So it's purely just to further specify what they're trying to define technical.
Representative O'Driscoll moves the A17-022. Any further questions on that motion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, nay. Motion prevails. A17 is adopted. Members, we have another amendment in front of us. It is the 1A amendment, and that deletes Section 1. And I believe there is a explanation in your handout on this A1 amendment. What does the amendment do, and the reasons why there has been a proposal to delete it? And basically, it expands the scope of the audit requirements, which is expensive. We've had the Austin situation in front of us. I think this is something that I'd like to have a healthy discussion on, adjusting that. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'd like to move the A1 amendment, or 1A amendment, I should say. And members just concerned about the expansion of the scope and what that means, both for the volunteer fire relief associations and then also what it means for the budget for the State Government Finance Committee. Does this require additional funds, or how does this all work? And I think that this needs some additional review, and so I'd like to offer this up as an amendment so we have some time to discuss this in greater detail.
Further comments, questions on the 1A amendment? Senator Pappas?
Yeah, Madam Chair, I do have concerns since this was a unanimous proposal from the volunteer fire departments, and maybe we need to hear from them about their position on this.
Absolutely. Mr. Johnson?
Well, the working group was, Madam Chair, the working group was unanimous to this particular bill. So I guess I apologize, Senator Pappas. I'm not sure what the question is.
We are actually, Mr. Johnson, looking for just there was an agreement to the total bill. We're deleting Section 1, which basically right now, currently, it does expand the scope of the audit requirement. And Section 6.65 requires the audits to include a legal audit in addition to a financial audit. So this arose because of the City of Austin situation where there was an error by the state auditor in the course of a legal audit. And so we are, you know, looking to really control, I think, that situation.
Thank you.
Mr. Zickman.
So, Madam Chair, members, I'm in no position to comment on the impact of the state government finance budget. You know, so my comments earlier were specific. They really have become a legal compliance audit, and for the past decade at least, the Minnesota Fire Chiefs, which has probably the most robust database of all the chiefs, as you can imagine, about 10% of those turn over every year. As we work with the auditor's office, so again, these audits come in, and then they do their review, and they find legal compliance issues, which is a big part of the audit. And so then we're working feverishly for months, because the only penalty in current statute is to withhold the state aid, which is extremely punitive, because then you penalize the entire workforce, the entire volunteer workforce. And so it just made sense to clarify that that is part of the audit, as long as you have the CPA. As the past fire chief at SBM Fire, you know, our auditors there doing the fiscal also check that legal piece, maybe because I had the additional knowledge of what's involved in these and knowing we needed to do it anyways. So I think you do need to continue review and try and balance those issues. I think 1 year in the last 10, we've been able to get all reliefs certified by the threshold deadline, so they got their fire state aid. But anywhere from 100 to 130 we start with that are still going through the compliance after the initial deadline. And then that list gets winnowed anywhere from 7 to 30 that we're frantically making calls, and there are always legal compliance issues, every one of them. So that's from the relief side why it needs to be in there. But, again, I'm in no position to discuss the impact of the state government finance, which that's your purview. So that's what you need to balance.
Representative Anderson.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Zickman. Yeah, you know, I think that this, you know, requires a lot more detail committee review, especially in the State Government Finance Committee, to talk about, are we increasing the burden on the auditor's office? If so, does this mean that they're going to be charging more rates to the cities? I think Representative Poppe came forward with an issue dealing with the City of Austin and their firefighter relief association, too, and I think that begs for further review on how we handle this entire situation. And I think I don't want to do a kind of Band-Aid approach to this. I think that we need to do a deeper dive and figure out what's the right approach for the firefighter relief associations and also for the state. And so at this time, I just don't feel comfortable accepting this section. I think we just need to do a little bit more homework on it. So I'd like to get that time. So thank you.
Mr. Kerr.
I just wanted to express our feelings about it. It's really just a clarification. They already do have a legal compliance audit performed by the CPA. Fire relief associations are a little different because they're nonprofit corporations on one hand, but in Chapter 424A, they're also defined as government entities. So the way the section in Chapter 6 used to be worded, it said local governments. So it kind of linked up, you know, you could look at Chapter 424A and say, okay, this is a government entity, it's a local entity, so it's a local government. So when it switched to political subdivision, I think that link of the terminology just got lost. So we thought this would be a good way to clarify that it is part of that audit that the CPA does. And we took the language from the statute for charter schools, which is 124A16, subdivision 1. So they're a similar entity in that they're both a nonprofit corporation usually, and they're also part of the public school system. So they have that dual nature as well. So we thought that language was appropriate. So at least from our perspective, that's why it's a clarification.
Madam Chair. Senator Pappas.
Thank you. Madam Chair, I understand the working group spent several months going over these provisions, and they did the deep dive that Senator Anderson is interested in seeing. And it does sound like in the end, you know, we want to kind of protect them from themselves by making sure they follow all the legal compliance issues. So it does seem to be an additional safety measure to make sure they're, you know, dotting their I's and crossing their T's and getting this work done. So I don't think we should adopt the amendment. I think we should stick with the original recommendations.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair. Senator Anderson, or Representative Anderson.
Mr. Kerr, can you tell me what the rates then would be? I assume that you're going to have different rates than that you're going to be charging the firefighter relief associations. You're going to have the one rate here and then the second rate here. But we don't know because you don't have these actually set somewhere. So can you tell me what the rates will be?
Mr. Kerr. Chair, Representative, this is the filing they do with our pension division, so we don't charge them for that.
Representative Anderson.
Well, Madam Chair and Mr. Kerr, Mr. Zickman said that this is to try and avoid some of the costs that the auditor then comes in and audits it, and the cities are having to pay for that. Did I mishear you, Mr. Zickman?
Mr. Zickman.
So, Madam Chair, members, so there's two costs. There's the cost by the local auditor doing the work, and if they have to repeat it. But the auditor's office has some fee that is charged for doing all the oversight, compliance, and reliefs, because that gets deducted from our fire state aid. And so anything we can do to reduce the cost on that side then also benefits that distribution of the fire state aid. I don't know if they have a rate or they just charge directly back the number of staff they have there, but...
And Madam Chair, Mr. Kerr, so I mean, that's my big question. Is this actually going to reduce the rate, or is this going to increase the rate? I would like to know what the rates would be.
Mr. Kerr.
Madam Chair, Representative, I can talk to people at my office and see if there's any impact.
Okay. Representative Albright.
Thank you. And maybe the first question for Mr. Zickman is when a volunteer fire association sets up their trust, in most cases they're going to establish that with a trust account or a trust service. Am I correct in that understanding?
Mr. Kerr, or Mr. Zickman?
Madam Chair, Representative Albrecht, I don't know how many set up trusts. The vast majority will work with somebody local. There's 270 of them in the SBI. There's 140 now in the statewide plan. If they do set up a trust, they're doing it through some investment broker or advisor or et cetera, and I wouldn't know beyond that level of detail.
Representative Albright.
Mr. Zickman, in my understanding, any time that you do establish that type of an account, it is under a certain parameter and regulatory environment, which means that you're setting up a trust account. And in most cases, that comes with the understanding that at the end of the year, you're provided with what are called audited financials, which means that the trustee acting on behalf of the account for the benefit of the volunteer fire department can be assured that the monies have met the test of the trustee that is handling those. And so to duplicate that, as the auditor's office is suggesting, would in fact raise the costs for your volunteer fire association, because in a sense you are duplicating the audit that's already taking place at the trust account level for the account where the account resides. And so from that perspective, I think we are causing harm to your volunteer associations if we don't adopt this amendment.
Mr. Zickman or Mr. Johnson.
Yeah, Madam Chair, members.
As treasurer, we, at least in Maple Grove, and I can speak, I think, generally, majority of the relief associations work with a local broker-dealer, Wells Fargo, Ameriprise, well-named broker-dealers. And the special fund, as outlined in the statutes, is what you have to have the assets. So they may or may not be a trust. In our case, we had a special fund account. And then each relief association has an investment policy statement that provides the direction and the guidance and that is annually reviewed and against the consistent statutes of the state. So in this particular case, a relief association today is working with an auditor who will audit their books, working with the broker-dealer to ensure that the reports that they're getting from the broker-dealer as well as the whole organization is, in fact, compliant. In this particular case, the auditors are already doing a level of the work around this particular issue. This change in the language here is really to just specifically state that and remind that that's what they have to be doing. They're already doing it now, so we're just cleaning up the language from a technicality standpoint. In terms of additional costs, to Niall's point, if an auditor has to go back and re-audit because of some change, then that would be the additional cost. But to my knowledge, I don't believe there's a cost additional from the state auditor's office or anything related to the trust.
Mr. Zickman.
And so, Madam Chair and Representative Albright, by osmosis and sitting in on training sessions that the auditor does and then just working with reliefs, that's not what the issues are. And so I've just made a quick list from memory of the things that end up not meeting the legal compliance. Many, many times the bylaws are not updated or they don't have the benefit level or they won't have a provision for a partial years of service. And so that's not submitted. If the city didn't ratify the benefit, had to ratify the benefit, they don't have that resolution transmitted as part of the audit. The broker investment certification, the conflict of interest, and then a calculation of benefits. So those are the types of things that are being looked for that, again, they'll hold up the fire state aid. In my own department, since I've left, they've called me up, Chief, we got this list. And our state aid is $355,000. And so that's the balance, and that's the discussion that you're trying to achieve is then do you penalize all those folks and accrue extra Albright. Time.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Zickman, what you've described is a fiduciary audit, not a CPA audit. And commensurate with what this language speaks to, it doesn't speak to a fiduciary audit. It's speaking to a CPA's audit. And what you've described is exactly why the amendment that Representative Anderson has put forward is so essential, because it does not address the very nature of what you've just described. So I would encourage approval of the amendment that Representative Anderson has offered.
Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So just so I understand it, this is a requirement that's actually being asked not of the state auditor, but of the people that audit your books. And all you're trying to do with this language, and I think it says that, is to say they should not just look at the numbers, but whether they're complying with the investment requirements. So this is basically just saying, A, you said what they're already doing, and second, why would we not want the auditors to be required to actually look at legal compliance so we don't run into problems? That's the essence of this?
Mr. Johnson.
Madam Chair, members, yes, that's essentially it. The auditors, the financial auditors, CPA firms, are already doing this. It's just not spelled out in the amendment or the legislation that was proposed last year, and this is a technicality to clean up the language.
Representative Thiessen. No?
Okay. I guess I just don't know why we wouldn't want to require the auditors to actually look at those issues. I mean, if we run into problems in 2 years where a fund has not complied with their investment advice and they run into legal problems, I don't want to be sitting here on the hook saying this pension commission decided we didn't really need to look at that.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to what Representative Thiessen said, though, nothing bans the Firefighter Relief Associations from requiring that of their CPA firm that they have already. They have the full authority to request that of them in the first place. But what this language does is it also extends it to allowing the state auditor to do it. And so that begs the question of, are we having a financial impact to the state government finance area? Is this going to require more staff? What's the fiscal note? And all of those issues that we need to discuss.
Representative Deason, to that point.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Has the fiscal note been run on this bill?
No.
And can the state auditor say that this is not going to require you to hire any more staff to do this since you're already doing it?
Mr. Kerr.
Madam Chair, Representative, I believe that's the case. I can confirm that, but yes, I strongly believe that that's the case.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to Mr. Kerr or to Mr. Zickman. The continued concern that I have is that most CPAs are not trained in fiduciary audit protocol. There is a very substantial body of knowledge as well as an accreditation profile that is nationally recognized on this subject matter. And in most cases, my previous work with CPAs elicited from them their desire not to move into that area because of the very specific nature of that in comparison to their CPA work. And so they would engage with those outside of their own firm to do that. And so it is very specialized. It's highly focused on the policy and protocols that Mr. Zickman described, aside from the financial matter of an audit. And I would just encourage, again, what Representative Anderson has said. I think that in light of just the expertise, notwithstanding, around this table as well as on the commission, the study group, I think that it warrants continued and substantial additional time on the matter.
Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If anybody knows, who does the legal compliance audit or the audits under 6.65 for school districts and for towns and for cities and for counties? Are those done by CPAs?
Mr. Kerr.
Madam Chair, Representative, yes.
Okay,
Representative Thiessen.
For all these other subdivisions, CPAs are doing the exact audit we're calling on these local auditors to do. So, I maybe you're raising an issue that we should change 6.65, but it seems like CPAs are already doing this work, and they're doing it effectively, and we haven't seen any problems with it as far as I know.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to Representative Thiessen's point, the context is a little bit of an apples to oranges comparison with regard to, in most cases, the school districts are investing their assets for the benefit of their teachers and their staffs through the TRA, the PARA, and other organizations which have a fiduciary element that is inherent to their establishment, unlike that which is through the voluntary associations that we're talking about here. So they already have that implicit and explicit to the audit that, from a fiduciary perspective, annualized and otherwise, to that protocol that is not inherent, as we've seen with the voluntary associations.
So, members, we do have a motion on the table, and there seems to be a great need for clarification on this section. I think we'll go ahead and vote on that motion with the caveat that we are going to continue this and probably ask the working group and the state auditor to work together to clarify this section, because we are definitely interpreting it completely different on both sides. So,
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Limmer.
Madam Chair, as the author of this bill, are you in favor of the amendment?
Yes, I am, Senator Limmer. It was actually my amendment.
It was. Okay.
Madam Chair?
Representative Thiessen.
As Representative Murphy is the author of the bill, are you in favor of this amendment?
No, because it's not through the work.
So this amendment needs more work? This section needs more work. I think that's what we are. But we do have a motion on the table for the discussion. Representative Driscoll.
Just from a procedural standpoint, if this were to be taken from the bill tonight through the amendment, the rest of the work could move forward, and there is some time that this pensions bill, if we get that language worked out through the processes that people have concerns, this could be added on it as an amendment at some point in the future, yes or no?
Yes. Yes. Or we could talk about addressing this next week after you have a chance to work on it. Is that a possibility? Does the work group get together and you can get this section more greater clarification?
Are you meeting?
No.
And we can take it up next week. But members, we are going to be taking testimony on Monday, May 1st, and voting on the bill May 3rd. So it is a very short time frame. Do whatever you want. Representative Anderson, renew your motion. Okay. Representative Anderson renews her motion on the A. Where is this again? The 1A amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay.
No.
The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Thiessen. Division has been requested. All those in favor, raise their hands, please. Eight. All those opposed, please raise your hand. The motion still prevails. Amendment is adopted. So with that, we will vote on the Senate file 1384.
Madam Chair, if I might.
Representative Driscoll.
Thank you. I would still encourage those who have an interest in the provision that was struck to try to find a way to work with that, because we still do have time to bring it back as an amendment.
Absolutely.
I just do not want to see the body of work be completely set aside moving forward, what there isn't controversy on in a comfort level for the commission, but still allowing the opportunity to be able to bring this back as a future amendment yet this session. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Driscoll. So we, Representative Driscoll moves that Senate file 1384 and House file 1672 as amended be recommended pass and incorporated into the 2017 Omnibus Pension Bill. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails.
Madam Chair, members, thank you for
your
continued support.
Thank you,
volunteers.
Mr. Johnson, Mr. Kirk, thank you very much. And we will continue to work on that. So members, we have item number four, which is Senate file 1705 and House file 2126. It's the Fairview MSRS issue. We did have public testimony quite a while ago, actually. We have three amendments. I think what I would prefer doing is having a good, robust discussion in the next 20 minutes that we have remaining about what to do with Fairview and a vote on Monday night when we have testimony for the whole bill. I have reached out to the governor's office and Commissioner France to get their opinion on how to move forward with this. And at 5:15, did not receive a call from Commissioner France, and he was still unclear, and he would prefer if we took the vote on Monday. But if we could take a look at these amendments and have a good discussion about how we want to move forward with this bill, if we want to vote the bill in its entirety or entertain any of these amendments. So I will ask Ms. Lincheski to go through the amendments. Ms. Lincheski, the 1A amendment, please.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. 1A.
Ms. Lincheski, could you just right now just give us a brief summary of what the board voted on, a little historical reference to get us back to how long this has been going on, and what the board had voted on last year, this year, and ongoing. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So this dates back to 1996, when the University of Minnesota Hospital spun off a chunk of their assets and employees to Fairview. So at that time, I believe there were about 5,000 people that went over to Fairview, and this was a contentious issue. A lot of things about this deal were contentious, but the pensions were one of the issues. There was no bargaining per se on this, but the legislature wanted to assist in making sure the deal would happen, so they went ahead with a number of changes to the statute that will just benefit this group. So the Fairview group is then entitled to a number of things. And, of course, it's legislation. There's nothing in it that makes it more or less effective than any other legislation. It can be changed by a subsequent legislature. But the one issue that we're talking about here is we refer to as augmentation, which is a COLA, essentially, an annual increase on the benefit of people who have left the employment of the state. So they are now over in the private sector working for Fairview, and their benefit that they accrued as of 1996 has been updated or has been increased every year by 5.5%. When they hit age 55, that augmentation rate goes up to 7.5%. So the benefit they had in 1996 increases every year by 5.5% or 7.5%. When they decide to retire and take their benefit, then they're able to, you know, take that that much larger benefit as a pension. So the this issue was something that the former executive director of MSRS felt should be addressed, because he took a look at the pension benefits that had been accrued by this group, and they were quite large relative to people who would have stayed with the state for that same length of time. So back in the 2016 session, Mr. Bergstrom, Executive Director Bergstrom, then brought this to his board. His board approved it, and the board change then was to drop augmentation for all of these Fairview people down to 2%. So that is the current rate for all other employees, other members of MSRS. And by the way, the change down to 2% is prospective only. So the benefits accrued to date would continue to stay in effect. It's just that the future rate of increase would drop from 5.5% or 7.5% to 2%. The board of MSRS took a look at this again more recently and determined that they wanted to back off on their earlier proposal in terms of the extent of the drop in the rate of augmentation. The board approved a drop in the augmentation down to 4.5%, but that reduction would not take effect until January 1 of 2021. So that is what the MSRS board has brought forward. That is what is reflected in the bill in front of you. The amendments would change the rate of augmentation. So Amendment 1A takes the rate down to 2%, which again is the current rate that all other MSRS members have. It actually ties it to the rate in the statute. So if the augmentation rate were to change, the rate for Fairview would change as well. Amendment 2A refers to the current rate for all MSRS employees, but adds 2.5% on top of that. So under the current augmentation rate, the rate for the Fairview folks would be 4.5%, but it would take effect on January 1, 2018, rather than under the board proposal 3 years later. Amendment 3A ratchets down the rate by 1% each year until it reaches the current rate. And I believe in the MSRS report that is in your packet, it shows how that 1% decline would occur, and that again is all future years. So as of January 1, 2018, the rate would go from 5.5% and 7.5% down to 4.5% and 6.5%, and would continue to decrease by 1% each year until it was the same as for all of their MSRS members.
Senator Pappas. Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Lencheski, I think I wasn't clear in your explanation if we're talking about these would all apply to, oh, I see, it's not like general augmentation where we can talk about future employees. These are all past or present employees. Okay, I answered my own question. Thank you.
I am ready for comments, questions.
I'm hoping to have some kind of vote on this on Monday, and really looking for some direction, members. Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, this is an issue that was brought up last year, and we had some really robust discussions and fact-finding on it. It was once again brought up this year. Again, some additional information, fact-finding. We had some testimony from individuals who came before the commission from the University of Minnesota, and it was of no decision of theirs that the state of Minnesota got out of the hospital business, if I can simplify it to that. And that Fairview was taking this over, and that by law you can't have some private pensions with private organizations can't have a public pension. And we had individuals who came forward and said that they didn't know that things might be changing on here, that there wasn't any notification. And privatization happened about 20-some years ago. And through that 20-some years, this commission has continually had to address things like employer-employee contribution increases, COLA reductions, other kinds of things, just because of the nature of the dynamic society that we live in, people living longer, healthier, and happier. And for the entire 20-plus years that this deal has been in place, this group has been pretty much held harmless, if you will, from any kind of concession or any kind of an ask to be able to help stabilize the entire plan. And, Madam Chair, I do fear in the way of equality and fairness for all members who are in MSRS that if we don't do something on this to be a player in helping to solve the bigger issue, we're asking current MSRS general employees through possible increases in their contributions, through public entity contributions, state increases, to in essence subsidize a 4.5% augmentation when currently MSRS individuals are not getting a 4.5% augmentation after they separate employment. It's down to 2%, and it had been higher, but again, as a part of stabilization in the past, there's been a ratcheting down. So and not at this point wanting to offer a comment about which specific strategy. I'd like to hear from other members, but I think as we go into this conversation, that's something we need to remember, is that it's one for all and all for one when we're looking at trying to sustain the viability of the pension plans. And, Madam Chair, with that, I'll look to hear what others have to say. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Eastman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, and just to refer, I missed the earlier meeting on this year, so I'm going back a year ago. But are there other circumstances where the Pension Commission has addressed basically what was a negotiated deal, not before the legislature, but as part of a business transaction, and then gone back and readdressed that? Because, I mean, there is a distinction here, I think, in that this was kind of negotiated as part of a business transaction. Mm-hmm. And so I know that we have sold other hospitals, but they usually just stay right in the plan, and we just allow that to happen. So is there any precedent where we've dealt with that in other circumstances?
Representative Thiessen, you were elected the same year I was. I cannot think of anything, but I am planning on bringing Ms. Leonard and Mr. Burkett up to perhaps they would have an answer to this. Oh, Ms. Lincheski, why they're coming up.
Mm-hmm. Representative Thiessen, Madam Chair, just to, I think, clarify, though, when you talk about an agreement, in the MSRS report that I prepared, I pulled up the actual asset purchase agreement, and there are provisions in there that relate to what Fairview has to provide these employees, and that is a pension plan at Fairview, a 403B plan, and there are some requirements as to how much they have to contribute. So there was an agreement. It was all spelled out in writing. There is nothing in that agreement that says the legislature has to now put in this enhanced augmentation. There is also nothing that requires, say, MSRS to work to get that augmentation into the statute. So when you talk about kind of the agreement that was negotiated at the time, there was a hope, I think, that this would happen, and the legislature wanted to make sure the deal happened, but it's not actually in any written agreement.
Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have no doubt that that's the case, but I don't know why that would. I mean, the state wasn't a party to the agreement, right? It was between Fairview and the Fairview and the university. So, unless they're a third-party beneficiary, I wouldn't see how they would include that language one way or another. Right. So, and clearly, based on the other testimony, this was part of the, whether it's in written writing or not, this was part of the understanding and the deal that was made. So, I guess that's what I'm asking about.
Representative Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Before we go to the testifiers, I just maybe want to comment on Representative Thiessen's point. As we know, the university here in the state of Minnesota has separate constitutional as well as independent authority and powers. And I am not sure if this deal with Fairview was negotiated under those, which really kind of limit the ability that the legislature has because of the constitutional autonomy that the University of Minnesota has. And so this may have been the legislature as the current provider of pension services and benefits being brought into this as a disinterested third party in a negotiation that they really didn't have the ability to weigh in on because of the constitutional independence of the University of Minnesota program. So I think that that's also something we might want to talk about.
Representative Thiessen.
No, thank you, Madam Chair. I guess the other question in light of this is what the timing of the passage of the pension bill that made these changes and the actual entering of the agreement between Fairview and the University of Minnesota, in what order those things took place, because I think that probably shed some light on this issue too.
Ms. Leonard or Ms. Burkert? Senator Schoen first, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I can see if I'm understanding the conversation between Representative Thiessen and Representative Driscoll. I guess, am I hearing correctly that there were, if the legislature approved the sale, then we probably need to know before we act on this whether we can make the changes due to a contractual obligation? Is that the discussion around the sale point? Or no, maybe I'm off base, but I'm just trying to figure out what a kid who grew up on a farm like me would understand exactly what you two were just talking about.
Representative Thiessen, you'd like to answer that question.
Sure. So as I've been thinking about this issue, I don't think that the legislature can change the law, and I don't think we're bound by any contract there. But the difference between this, it seems to me, and what we and other pension changes, usually we just do the pension stuff because we set the law that all the pensions have to follow, right? But this is, in some sense, a unique circumstance because it was a negotiated deal. And so I just am wondering if that is actually a factual distinction, what conclusions we draw from that. I don't know. I mean, I think one conclusion you could draw from that is if this was a negotiated deal, it's different and we should honor that deal. And that's partly why I asked the question about did the state legislature pass the pension changes that allowed for this augmentation before the contract was entered, because if that happened, that would also tell us that actually informed the final meeting of the minds around that contract, if that helps.
Representative Thiessen, are you looking at the timeline here, too? It says in 96, the signed U of M and Fairview signed the asset transfer agreement and closed the transaction. And then the following June, legislation enacted to amend it. So we amended it after that. But
I'm not sure that.
Well, it looks. Ms. Leonard or Mr. Burkett, would you like to?
Madam Chair, Chad Burkett, MSRS. I think that the amendment from the following June had to do with just the University of Minnesota physicians.
Oh, okay.
And it didn't have to do with augmentation, enhanced augmentation for the original group.
And I think if you look up to April 11th, sorry, Madam Chair, 1996.
Right. You're right. But I'd like to have a discussion with you guys. Ms. Leonard, would you like to comment on this?
So Erin Leonard from MSRS. Our board, after hearing our stakeholders' feedback or the members of this particular group, revised their proposal because at the time the enhanced augmentation was put in place, it was 2.5% greater than the existing augmentation for all of our other members. And so they took that approach with this revised proposal. They also, the individuals that we met with expressed concerns about the timing and the ability to plan. They, you know, we've been providing them estimates of an unexpected benefit that they might receive, and which is why we, the board, proposed that delayed effective date. So those are the two things that seem to be concerning for the individuals that are impacted by this provision. I don't think that the board did hear about the negotiated agreement. I think that they're sympathetic to this group of people. They went through a difficult transition, and so that's where they developed the proposal that they did.
The current proposal?
The current proposal, yes.
What about the 2016 proposal? Why? I mean, that is completely different, and it's just because of circumstances. People, what happened?
Sure, Madam Chair and members. So I think at the time in the 2016 proposal, we were trying to bring this group equal to our other members. There was a lot of feedback that we didn't expect from stakeholders and the individuals impacted. And so then after the commission instructed both the LCPR staff and MSRS to go and do some outreach with these individuals impacted and come up with an additional proposal or revised proposal. And so we ended up listening to that feedback, and that's why the proposal was revised.
Okay. Questions? Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Ms. Leonard. So, and I'm tying into what Representative Thiessen as well as Representative O'Driscoll said, and when you look at this from a legality standpoint, the contractual arrangement was between the University of Minnesota and Fairview. And the University of Minnesota is quite different in terms of its legal ramifications as it would infer to the legislature. So did you receive any type of a legal opinion in terms of the responsibility of MSRS to weigh in and be responsible for a contractual agreement, merger or otherwise, between those two entities?
Ms. Leonard.
Madam Chair and Representative Albright, to my knowledge, we don't have any legal opinion regarding that contractual arrangement. I think this specific provision is in our section of law. It happened prior to the merger. I'm not a lawyer. I'm not sure if those individuals would have some legal recourse if we modified the statute or not.
Representative O'Driscoll.
No? Albright.
Albright. Sorry.
Okay. Please, O'Driscoll. Maybe I can ask this of Ms. Lancheski then. So in the research that you gleaned from the legal documents, was there inference or explicit language that obligated one party or the other to fund the retirement plans in a certain way? Or was there an understanding going forward? I mean, help me understand in terms of what legal obligations you were able to glean that either party were held to as they consummated the merger.
Ms. Lancheski.
Yes, Representative Albright and Madam Chair. Page 3 of this report does lay out the timeline. And I think as Representative Thiessen was suggesting, the legislation was approved in April of 1996. The deal was actually then closed after that on December 31st, 1996, so several months later. In the documents, the agreements that were signed up at the end of 1996, there is no mention of this benefit. There's no mention of any funding for it or anything obligating any party to maintain this level of benefits. So I think that probably was because it was legislation. And so there's nothing that can bind the legislature to, you know, do anything, really. Every year you all can change anything in the statutes that you determine you want to. So as far as the legal, you know, contractual obligation, I didn't find anything in the agreements relating to this transaction. And I did a lot of reading in newspaper articles and other things around this time in order to put this together. And again, there's nothing to suggest that anybody felt there was any contractual obligation regarding these benefits.
Madam Chair, Ms. Lancheski, did then also, are we to infer by what you just said, that indemnified either party from their previous contractual obligations to this group for continued contributions at a certain level?
Ms. Lencheski. Yeah.
Madam Chair and Representative Albright, there's no language at all regarding anybody having to pick up any funding shortfall or any contributions to the plan to pay for these benefits. At the time, MSRS was overfunded, so they were at about 110%. So I think the feeling was that they could take on this kind of a liability and that, you know, things would be fine in terms of the funding. So no indemnification language or any promises about making payments to address shortfalls or contributions. There's nothing in any of the documents to that effect.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Lencheski, do you feel then, not from a legality perspective, but just to understand, would it be the presumption that a precedent has been set or not?
Ms. Lencheski.
Representative Albright, Madam Chair, you know, everything you all do is a precedent. I guess the question, is it a binding precedent? I think, again, the legislature can do whatever they want to do and throw out precedent. So there, I don't see anything, you know, in the history of, you know, this deal that makes this any different than any other piece of legislation, you know, any other provisions in the statutes.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And back to Ms. Leonard. Do you feel that there's been a precedent set based upon the way that you viewed the documents?
Ms. Leonard.
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, I will honestly admit that I did not view as many documents as Ms. Lencheski and Mr. Burkett did most of the work on this report because it preceded my current role. I think that in recent years we've modified several benefits for our membership, and which is why our board proposed modifying this benefit as well.
Representative Albright.
Madam Chair and Ms. Leonard, you mentioned in an earlier response to a question I gave you in terms of legal recourse that might be coming our way if parties to this agreement didn't find favor with what we decided here. Am I to presume then that they are assuming precedent being set by the consummation of the deal and the length of time and other actions by the legislature having been taken in years prior?
Ms. Leonard.
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, no mention of legal action has been shared with me. I will say that in 2010, when we modified the benefits for our general plan and our other plans, we were served the next day regarding some cost of living adjustment changes and went through the legal process regarding those changes and prevailed because of the circumstances surrounding the changes, the underfunding and other things, and the fact that it was impacted several groups within the membership. Beyond that, I don't know if we've never been challenged on augmentation or this specific issue.
Representative Albright.
Madam Chair, and I'll just conclude by maybe an op-ed that I think that, you know, the decision that we're considering taking next week, I think obligates us to take into consideration what the opinion of legal counsel might provide to us, just for the very sake of the nature of the precedent that I think is in some cases inferred based upon previous decisions not only made by this commission but by the legislature itself in response to the merger and acquisition. So I would just encourage us to seek that legal opinion and or observation, recommendation, however you want to describe it, in lieu of the history that Ms. Lencheski has provided to us.
Thank you, Ms. Representative Albright. That's a very good suggestion. We will do that for next week. Any other suggestions, observations, questions? Representative Murphy?
As long as we're seeking information from legal, but could we also have some explanation from I believe it was TRA that we changed their augmentation from 6% down to 2% sometime back. And what kind of feedback did they get as a result of that? The legislature was adamant that we could do this, and we did it. Some people were not happy. And see what the experience was with the people at that time. I also think that as we're discussing, then, and we're talking about the bill that we're going to vote on May 3rd, and we're making some considerable change. If some of what's been suggested goes through, we're making some considerable changes in what people's expectations were 5 years ago as compared to 5 years from now in that bill. And would we have the right to do that if we don't move this at this time? The people from Fairview, fine. They had this for over 20 years. They've had at 6%, maybe higher, for over 20 years. We're not saying, now we're saying stop, and this is where we start again. They could take the money out then, I believe, when the 6% stops, whatever date we say, 6% will stop. But if you choose to continue, you'll keep the 6% that you've earned so far, and we're going forth with 4.5 or 2. I think that's what I see in the two options, or else a tiered down 2 to 2 choice. And they can make the choice of which ones they want, or if they want to continue adding 2 to their collection of money that they got under 6. But some choices have to be made, and if we're talking on this other bill, the total bill that we're going to have, some choices where the cost of living, things that were promised, are going down because of circumstances and because we have to have a sustainable program for everyone active and already on pensions to go. So we can't, I don't see how we can bind ourselves forever if circumstances have changed. And I'm not saying that we should take any of the 6% away up to this date or whatever date we choose, July 20th or July 1st or August 1st or 2000. But I really do think it has to be, it shouldn't be 2020. I really think it should be 2017. But that's my opinion. That's what I said. That's all my thoughts at this particular time on the exact question plus everything else that's messed up in here.
Thank you. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Murphy, I agree. I think, though, in the line of questioning that you've been hearing the discussion, whether it be from me, from Representative Thiessen, or others, I think it's about whether we are being involved in a decision, not of our own making, but we are asked to, in a sense, fix it. And I wonder if some of the folks that ought to be involved in this decision aren't here, that being the University of Minnesota and Fairview, because they were the ones to which they are bound by this merger acquisition, but yet we seem to, because pensions is in the vernacular, that somehow it's coming to us, whether it be through funding to the University of Minnesota or just because of, you know, other affiliations. And so my concern about the legality is not only to precedent, but because, to in a sense safeguard future considerations if it is found that we are a disinterested third party that really should not be entertaining this conversation. I would like for that legal opinion to be first adjoined to. I think that gives us a clear path to make a decision in terms of who ultimately is responsible for making the decision, as opposed to, in a sense, making the presumption that we are and then moving forward without the people that were at the table to begin with to give us a little background, but also the legal opinion that would outline our responsibilities to the people affected.
Well, members, this will be a very big vote and decision, and move forward. I'd like to have your feedback through the week if you so choose, and plan on probably going on past 7 o'clock next week. We have to finish up our work. Are there any further comments or questions? Okay. Thank you very much. Yes, Representative Murphy.
Madam Chair, are we starting at 5:30 again?
Yes, we are. But perhaps I will bring some food for us, too. That would be good. With that, the meeting is adjourned. Thank you very much, members.